So what's that representation by showing this conversational data? So all the data I'm going to show you today are natural occurring conversation in workplaces in Australia, which I collected during my PhD study. So this is a conversation taken from one of the leading TV commercial production companies, mainly dealing with Japanese clients. I'm going to read it through, so I want you to think about what sort of linguistic and cultural background J, H, and AD have. So I'm not going to disclose their names yet. So the conversation starts off with Jake. Hoo-hoo, wine or juroko? Haha, 16 bottles of wine. And it goes, yeah. And AD goes, nande? Doko kara moratta no? Why? Where did you get them from? And Jake responded, ah, I bought them off the internet. There's like a sale, special sales master at the moment. And then she goes, offering a 60 bottles of wine, but I want to keep it here. And then from line 11, Edge said, oh, Iteyo, you should have told me. And then Jake said, Madapio, they still have some, and Ponto, really. Okay? Anyway, so at first glance, this is nothing very remarkable about this conversational fragment between J, A, and H. Code switching, we know, is common and widely attested in contexts where two languages are used in daily interaction. In this company, where Japanese and English are frequently used for both business and social purposes, it is common to find dialogues such as this, where this can switch and mix between English and Japanese. However, what is intriguing here is that none of the participants in the conversation, J, H, and AD, are Japanese. I'm so called Japanese, depending on what you mean by Japanese. So want to move on to the next slide. So this is your interview data from the same participants. So when I ask what people say about me, what do you think about, what do you think about language choice, or what language do you use? And then Adam said that I don't consciously speak in English or in Japanese, I choose the one I feel comfortable with at the time. Heather said, I don't have any awareness that I'm choosing language. And then Jen said, when I recall a particular conversation, it is often the case that I can't remember in which language it was spoken. So it is very interesting that in the first conversational data, you can see that the Japanese language was used, even though there was no dominant Japanese speakers for there. And also, this is also interesting that these participants do not have a notion of having two codes when they speak, because they think there is no way of awareness of switching or using two different languages. So there are a range of work that has come to question the connection assumed between language and forms of belonging. What I'm interested in here is to explore how Adam's, Heather's, and Jane's language use can be understood differently. And so as examples shown in the previous slides have led us to question one-to-one the association between language, ethnicity, nation, and territory, and also the authenticity and ownership of language, which is based on conventional language ideology. What I mean by conventional language ideology is like a traditional European language ideology, that the French language spoken in a French colony or French, France, the ethnicity and the nation state language were kind of having a one-on-one relationship. And then also the notion of discrete language also can be challenged as well. So I want to show you another data. So this is from the same company, Japaria, the same company as the conversation I showed at the beginning. And this time the conversation was held between Asuko, Richard, Adam, and Asami. And they were having lunch. So this is during the lunch break. And they were watching TV because they were working for a TV commercial company. But anyway, so Asuko started by saying, 今の何語だった? What was it? Which language was it? And Richard was playing French, France go. And Adam was the air. And then Asuko continued to say, France-go? France-go しゃべる人ってかわいいしかっこいいと思う. French? I think people who speak French are cute and cool. And then Adam took a question and said, みんな? 国全体がかわいくてかっこいいと思う. You mean everyone? You think everyone in the country is cute and cool? And Asuko, どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも。どうも all French people. I mean that. And then I'm going to cut the mustard. So I'm going to cut the mustard. from this point that he's just taking kind of teasing this, joking about this. And then France, you know, excited, and then he said everybody's naked, and so we're all. Again, it's sort of like interesting. But at the beginning, even though the conversation topic they found is very dramatic, but at the beginning when Asiko started, she just said unconsciously about giving a comment about French people unconsciously. Then it's very interesting because when I interviewed them, so Asiko, when I interviewed about her perception about language and culture, she said, I don't consciously think that I am Japanese. I stopped being aware of noticing people as Japanese or Australian. So the very person that who categorizes French people as cute or whatever is the person who doesn't want to be seen as Japanese or be categorized in boxes as Japanese. Asami, who said that the French people do not brush their teeth, is the very person that who said, especially people in the country, there are many people who think Japanese people are dead like this, or Japanese people always eat fish, and I do not like that. So, and then Adam is the one who picked up Asami's Asuko's comment at the beginning by contesting and saying, everybody in France or something. But he's the one who said, I think I'm a big Japanese, I cannot say this directly. I am not as direct as Gaijin. Gaijin means non-Japanese Caucasian, or Caucasian speaking. So he doesn't have an idea of what constitutes Japanese. He thinks that Japanese people cannot say this directly. But at the same time, he's traumatized as was comment. So from here, from the first excerpt, you can see one-to-one association to language, ethnicity, national heritage need to be traumatized in certain contexts. And also the authenticity and ownership of language, which is based on conventional language ideology, as well as the notion of discrete language, can be questioned. And from the second excerpt, we could observe active interaction between border and borderless idea about culture and identities. So this indicates the complexity of cultural and linguistic understanding with people moving between fixed and fluid views and linguistic practices. So my question is, what constitutes social inclusion in this ambivalent space between fixed fluidity and fixity, as well as between borderless and bordered practice? So this paper aims to disinvent conventional language ideologies in multilingual workplaces. It also attempts to explore the contribution of both fixed and fluid linguistic practices and their interaction. And at the end, I would propose that the notion of metrilingualism, which I'm going to explain to you in a minute, that is a creative, transgressive language ideology as a way to explore social inclusion and social exclusion. So I want to talk a little bit about metrilingualism, what we mean by metrilingualism. So the notion of metrilingualism was inspired by the notion of retroethnicity, and that was proposed by Maha in his paper 2005. And in his paper, he looked at a young Japanese ethnic minority, Ainu's ethnic group in the northern part of Japan. And so in his work, so he was looking at how he was rewriting his own ethnic identities without being able to speak Ainu language. But he was very proud of being Ainu, even though he could speak a word of the Ainu language, but he was associating himself with Italian culture and language. So he was learning Italian culture, and he was like learning Italian cooking, and he was telling that, I want to be cool Ainu. So I want to be constituted, I want to revive what it means to be Ainu. So he acknowledged that he would be seen as Ainu, he's got Ainu name and everything, but he wants to change what it means to be Ainu. So Maha defined metroethnicity as an exercise in emancipatory politics. It is an individual self-assertion on his own terms, and that will inevitably challenge the orthodoxy of language loyalty. So I just prepared a paper together with my supervisor and Penny Cook, and we thought that this notion of metroethnicity is very useful when we talk about So we wrote the sentence, we thought that metroethnicity allows the reconstitution of language and the alternative way of being in the moving of the other possibilities. So I'm going to read this slowly. Now, this is the excerpt from extract from paper, and this is the definition of what we mean by materialism. So materialism describes the ways in which people of different and mixed backgrounds use, play with, and negotiate identities through language. It does not assume connections between language, culture, ethnicity, nationality, and geography, but rather seeks to explore how these may be open categories. Its focus is not on language system, but on languages as emergent from context of interaction. So as you can see from the first conversation data that they were mixing language, they don't have a sense of mixing, but they need, like, in the front end where this is appearing emergent. And then another thought, we wrote that there is an emancipatory politics in the challenge to the orthodoxy of language loyalty that may enable people to dissociate legitimized links between language, ethnicity, and nation state, and this is in turn renovates the discursive content of what it means to be Japanese or to speak in Japanese. So the important point about, not important, but one of the main points about ethnicity is that we are not only looking at fluid identity, language use, but we are also going back to essentialism at some times. So we have some set of idea about language, like French people this or French people like that, but at the same time, this mobilizes language as well. So, in that note, we could also revisit essentialism, especially the ways in which metrolinguals may both reject and mobilize fixed culture identities. So, just want to show you another data from another company. So this is a company called Bridge, and this is a company that provides various services and products to Japanese working holiday makers. And Osman was working there as a clerical assistant. His father was Turkish, but his father was Anglo-Saxon and Australian, and his mother was a Turkish migrant, and he was born and bred in Australia. He couldn't speak Turkish, but he could understand Turkish. Anyway, so he had this identity crisis throughout his life, when he was small, and he said that I could not fit into either Turkish or Australian culture, and I was always unconsciously searching for a place where I belong. I always thought that I was not a typical Aussie. When I was in my teens, I was a target of physical abuse in my neighborhood, and even I came to visit to his offices a number of times. And then I cannot get along with people Australian. Number five, I have a Japanese way of thinking, and I have a feeling that I could live in Japan for the rest of my life. So when he was traveling, he read this Japanese book, it was called Bushido, which is about Japanese mentality, and then he really thought that he can align his identity with that. So from that point of time, that he thought that, yeah, I'm not Turkish, I'm not Australian, I am Japanese, so that's how started to get Japanese. So, anyway, so it's interesting that he was claiming his ethnic identities, I mean, as Japanese, by using a language of Japanese language and culture. But this conversation is interesting because you can see the tensions between what he wants to be and what he's doing. Anyway, so Osman is having a casual conversation with Rie. So Rie is his manager. So she was office manager, and then Osman is a clerical assistant. So in a normal or professional or normally Japanese workplace, you normally have to show difference of respect to your boss by using honorific language or specific language. But he was calling his boss, Rie, by her first name. Normally we call, use family name with positional of the job of his manager or something. So Tanaka Bucho, that's how you normally say. But he didn't use first family name, but he used first name, Rie, and Chan in this like informal address terms. So he called her Rie-chan. And then there are a few informal language here, but most notable choice, his interesting choice, is here in 97. So Osman said to Rie, kimi. So he said, you do not have a good memory, you. Kimi means you, but kimi is used from senior to junior normally. So it's very uncommon. Or it means certainly that it's deviated from Japanese workplace norm to use kimi to your own boss. And there was a significant silence after that. And then Osman called up and said, Rie-chan wa kimi te yondara, sugoku okoru kara sa. He knew that hates and doesn't like to be called Kimi, but at the same time, he used it very much. So as you can see that the Ottoman Chinese leader, by using Kimi, and this shows his attempt to test how much he can push his informality and show the ambivalent flexible linguistic and cultural space in between, as well as, and also he claims to be included in Japanese society, but at the same time he challenges the normative practice by performing different ways. Anyway, so I'm just going to show it very quickly. Another case from the same company bridge, Sandra is there, was also a who was working for Lie, and then Sandra had a different investment in language, Japanese language. So for her, she was from a working class background. She was studying law in Japanese at the time of data collection. And for her, to speak Japanese was shift from a working class background to a middle class background. So she said that she was the first person to go to university in her family. And then so she said that if you can speak a foreign language, you will have more opportunities in life. So she was comparing herself with her classmate in law school, that most of her classmates had parents with a professional background, like lawyers or doctors, and then she thought that these people had capital already, that they didn't have to work, study hard, but that they passed through the exams easily. For her, she has to study hard, and then knowing doing any extra to law degrees, like study Japanese, the way to So when she talked with her clients, it's not a casual conversation by the way, but a customer, she was like using proper language, like not proper, but the normative language and conforming to the way the way that Japanese people normally speak. So Sandra's used Nasatta Kochira. Nasatta, this is the honorific language. And Kochira is another honorific language. Bozonji desu means, do you know that? I mean, the content is not that important, so I'm just picking up these three words. But she is using like very formal language, and so she is very different from Osman. Because when Osman served customs, he was using very formal language again. So Rika, their boss, commented on Osman and Sandra's language choice. So Rika commented, Sandra speaks academic Japanese, and she knows a lot of sophisticated vocabs, but is not so familiar with Japanese spoken amongst friends. Sandra's Japanese is very sophisticated, proper. Our customers do not get offended by her language. Many of our customers model after Japanese language skills. Osman knows things about Japan which I would never expect him to know. I think I have had more casual conversation with Osman. We discuss a wider range of topics. Sandra declined our invitation a couple of times to go out together because of her study commitments. Osman normally take a day off to go out with Japanese people. So anyway, I mean, I want to talk about this perspective talking about social inclusion, but I go very quickly. If I go back to the first like the company, the Caria, so there were James and Adam and Richard and Asuko. But this is what James said about honorific language choice use. So he said that I do not use honorific language, Keigo, much. I personally believe that one should speak equally. So even if I talk to someone senior or older, I deliberately speak normally if we are doing the same job. So it's different from the Sandra. And then Adam was born and bred in Japan because his parents were missionaries, so his Japanese is very I dare to emphasize that I am Gaiji, non-Japanese. If they think that I'm Japanese or I'm not so much different from Japanese, then they will expect me to behave like Japanese. So when I answer the phone, I speak in English first and then switch to Japanese. So this can be seen as strategies for social inclusion through contesting and transgressing and fixing transgressing a fixed and normative understanding about Japanese language. So you can see from Osman's case, and this is another example. So to sum up, so you could observe different ways of proclaiming and performing social inclusion. So in Osman's case, so he was breaking an ethnic language tie by having an essentialized view of Japan and yet pushing the border of normative practice by using formal language. Sandra, on the other hand, she would establish her new class Commodifying Japanese and people from Japan, transgressors, transgressing conventional language ideologies and creating a political space. So, then what constitutes social inclusion in a multilingual workplace? Whose perspective are we talking about social inclusion? Whose perspective? So, social inclusion is, as you can see from my data, that is complex and multilayered, and it indicates the complexity and flux of cultural understanding of people moving between fixed and fluid views, and is an ambivalent space amid interaction between border and borderless, as well as fixed and fluid idea about culture, language, and identities. And social inclusion is realized through conforming, contesting, and transgressing the fixed and normative understanding about language, culture, and identity. This is a very nice answer, I'm running out of time now. So if you go back to metrolingualism and social inclusion, so as I said at the beginning, the notion of metrolingualism does not assume connection. But I was thinking just now that metrolingualism does and does not assume connections between language, culture, ethnicity, nationality, and geography, but rather seeks to explore how these may be open categories. So if you take up this notion, so the metrolingualism can provide possibilities to construct one's transcultural space by using linguistic and cultural resources, and it goes beyond common ways of framing language and has the capacity to deal with contemporary urban language practices and new ways to think about social inclusion.